So I want to say two or three words about Jungian psychology, because I think Jungian psychology has a lot to offer to understand what actually is going on in society, to understand our situation in cultures. As you know, one of the most, I think, important messages of Jung is, of course, that we have to understand ourselves as having psyche, and psyche is not just something which is constructed, as we nowadays say, by the surrounding, but psyche has its own goals. It's an autonomous energy. And I think this notion is very important. It's an autonomous energy which has its own set of goals, has its own agenda. And the agenda actually is not just defined by the culture we belong to. It's not just, we're not just a result of will, by what we want, but somehow has an unconscious goal which is embedded in ourselves. So I think Jung stressed that actually we can only partially understand ourselves, that we always remain a bit of a mystery, and parts of our motives, parts of our goals are hidden, actually. So we somehow act and behave and in a way where we might afterwards try to interpret what we do, but at the moment when we actually act, we might not understand it. So I think this is important. And by saying soul has its goals, it also means that soul chooses, selects, has its own pattern of selecting what seems important. So it's not just, if I talk about, it's not just that we're prone to take up what is in the surrounding, but somehow we have our own way of choosing. And this process of choosing is a process which is done without us having control over it. And this depends on various things. For instance, something like a small exercise you can always do, if you try to think, what do you remember of, let's say, the last 2 weeks? What stays in your mind? What can you keep? Then it's with most of the people, they remember things which are not actually of high priority in their usual agenda. So I can see myself too. I usually look back over a week, and then I might have a week where I have to hold a speech somewhere, an important meeting, and so. And if I look at the agenda, I'd say this is important, this is so, this was very lively. But what one keeps in one's mind, in memories, is usually something completely different. So there you can see that the soul selects certain, it can be a detail. I remember one week what struck me most was seeing a young man getting so angry that he bumped his head into a pole. I just saw this, driving in the car, I looked out, and I thought, and that stuck in my mind, this young man bumping his head on a pole. So this stuck, and it was very clear and distinctive, so I still can see it exactly. And another time I remember, if I think of the, I once studied to become a teacher, and we had a year course, and if I look back, I had many people talking to me, many exams I had to take, many things I had to do, writings. But what stayed in my mind is just one small incident. It was an incident where we visited once a school for deaf-blind children. They were deaf and blind, and then they showed us how they would dance and listen to music. And they were all lying on the floor, a bit disorientated, and some of them were slightly disfigured. They were there lying on the floor and holding their hands. And then they made music by sort of resonating the floor, so the floor would vibrate, and so they would listen to the vibration, so that's how they tried to make music. And then I saw someone, a girl, sort of not having a lot of expression on her face there, touching her hands, and then the floor started to vibrate, and suddenly she got up, started to smile, and made a dance. And that was the image which stuck for my whole formation as this particular image. So, but if I start to search, you might learn a lot of competences, didactics, education, but that's what stuck. So there you see, soul selects by its own means, has its own goals. It selects things which it takes out and says, this might be important, this might contain something, a message. So and so this is actually, or in other words, we say soul is a bit anarchy. It doesn't abide to the rules, to the laws of actually what civilization wants to do. So civilization is one thing, but what stucks in our mind, what touches ourselves, is something completely different. And I think this is something. Now, when you look at the different experiences, there's certain experiences which somehow reach more in depth, reach deeper, where you think they have suddenly a kind of significance. Suddenly they touch you, soul glimpses. And these are also often the most important moments where people make their decisions, when they decide to marry, when they decide to take some kind of profession. So there's usually irrational things where suddenly something comes into mind and it's clear that they have to go this particular way. I remember someone choosing his profession by going into a lecture hall, and then it was just the way the demeanor of the professor which made him decide not to study that particular, you know. It was something, it was completely irrational. Of course, according to the rhetoric of our society, we could never argue that way. We have to then again adapt, you know, adapt to the usual rhetoric. And say, well, after careful evaluation, I thought that. So. That's just the way one has to talk, or in other words, how we make noises, share noises. And we always have to share the noises. We always have to share the noise actually with the surrounding, and we're not allowed actually. This doesn't have any space. This so-called soul glimpses, this is something where we actually have no notion for that, or no vessel for that, by the fact that soul actually selects. And when you have these kind of experience, they also give you a sense of purpose, or a meaning. You suddenly have the sense. And the sense of doing something purposeful is not something rational. It's usually something which is combined with the image. It's combined with an experience. It's combined with some kind of being selection process where you don't have a lot of influence. I saw it in a course I'm giving of someone who worked in a banking business. I was actually quite wealthy, and he chose to become a social worker. And he said it was just one particular experience, morning, where he went into the bank and he saw these monitors, you know, different monitors, and then he realized, I have to get out of here. So it was, it can be also the contrary, of course, you know, that you're a social worker and realize you have to go into the banking. It doesn't exist, but good, theoretically, you know. So it's this, you know, this kind of experience where you see actually soul, a soul experience. Also the fact which actually we have these kind of irate, you know, moments which come into our minds where soul expresses each other, not just in our lives, of course, during the night, dreaming. And it's one kind of great fallacy, I think, of our society that dreams are not taken into consideration. The dreams, actually, the fact that we have, every night we get some kind of images which contain messages we don't understand, which are not which don't concur with the surrounding we live in, which don't concur with the media. You know, the dreams are not made up by the media, by the major player, by television station. Dreams are composed in a way we often completely don't understand. So they're irate. They can bring us away from the patterns we usually follow, abide to. But as I said before, the patterns are usually defined by the societies belong to. The self-images are usually also referenced to the surrounding. So there's always a kind of limitness we've got there. So we're not broad, we're limited when we function within society. But as a contrast, you have soul. So for contrast, you have this production of images, of ideas, of fantasies, strange dreams, which don't make any sense, which actually connect us to another realm. And I think that one of the fallacies of our society is that the rituals somehow disappeared, where we really somehow take into consideration or value these kind of images which come in. You could even, you know, a lot of people talk about, think of the Romans, you know, the Roman Empire being very materialistic. The Romans, you know, building streets, building bridges, and having a tremendous military, you know, a very efficient, skilled militaries everywhere. But actually, in the Roman Senate, it was absolutely a rule that if you had a dream which was important, a dream when you were a senator, a dream which concerned the state, you had to go and tell it everyone, all the members of the Senate. So it was allowed to talk about dreams. You had an opening speech that said, listen, I had this dream, and this dream, da-da-da-da-da. So this is inconceivable nowadays. You know, you have no politician said, I had this dream, I don't understand it. Yes. So you see, actually, a lot of the official talking is just a tuning in to the rhetoric, to the noise a society makes, which is necessary to be bigoted, which is necessary to enclose yourself, to close down in order to function that respects the society. But actually, the other area, the other notions, the new, maybe different ideas, that actually they have difficulty in entering. They have difficulty to be listened to because there's a lack of rituals. Also, you know, if you look at the bazaar in the Osmanian Empire, for instance, you always had different people selling grapes, maybe selling other goods, and then you always had dream interpreters. Dream interpreters was one very important profession. Now, of course, you have some Jungians who interpret dreams, but they're a very extreme minority. And if you talk about dreams, you know, then dream interpretation has been degenerated often, you know, to supermarkets, small booklets, this means this. This is, of course, not dream interpretation. It's actually sort of trying to control the content. So you see, actually, we have soul, I think. We have soul which serves for a purpose. And we select certain things out, but it does not abide to actually civilization. And it does not concur with the way actually we function, actually we grow up. The result is, of course, then that we're not aware of what might happen. You know, we're not aware where actually soul intermingles with our society. What it also needs, of course, when you think of the soul, that when soul chooses, we also need, of course, a language to reflect on that, what soul is actually doing, what is actually happening. And in a language, of course, we would use, it has to be a bit vague. It can't be very clear, distinct, because when it's too distinct, you pin it down, and then you lose the distinct, autonomous quality of soul. So it's actually probably more images, pictures are more appropriate, or vague ideas, but not very clear, down-to-earth ideas. So if you start, you know, working with concepts or, you know, through figures, nowadays, actually, in psychology, you just talk about psyche with figures, you know, with data, significance, that's how it's done. So actually, but it needs more a sort of a vague language. One possibility, of course, is mythology. You know, I think mythology is a great idea, is a great resource to reflect on the different qualities, dynamics of soul, because mythology developed usually throughout the years, throughout centuries. So it's not something which has just been thought up. It's something which people has interacted with, people kept in their minds for a long, long time period. Mythology is important because mythology, the myths, let's say the myths of gods or the myths of demons, the myths always have are a reference to trying to grasp something which is beyond understanding. So that actually is the important moment. So when you talk about, if you talk about something like, you know, the mythology of the of Greek, you know, the Greek mythology, if you talk about Apollo, Dionysos, these figures always contain an autonomous will. So you never really know what they really do. Also by mythology, it's not really attached to our society. So if you talk about Apollo, for instance, it's better to have some kind of vague image than to say, well, Apollo is the, I don't know, the director of information of our university, you know, then it's too concrete. So you need something which is a bit beyond the concreteness. And I think that's the language in psychology which is very important. But now I come back to the first part. Of course, now you can look at our whole society as this pursuing happiness from perspective of psychology and mythology. And you can see then actually that when you perceive what is happening, it's probably clandestine, hidden myths which are directing us. So, for instance, one says shopping malls are probably new temples. It's a temple actually where one tries to get in fluid, one tries to get something in contact. It may be, if you word it, if you categorize it, it may be something like Hermes, hermeneutic, because it's moving, it's materialistic, it's the boundaries. And so it's actually, it's when we go to a shopping mall, we're probably adhering to Hermes, you know, Hermes, if you put it. It's also, you move around, you let, you know, you take material goods because you're connected with various places. If you look at the goods which you buy here, they come from throughout the world. So it goes beyond boundaries, and so, and also the, you know, all the symbols are that way. So it's actually a new way. Or if you look when people dine out, I think it's very interesting for spirits which might change your mind. You also need a container. Spirits need a container, you know, because human beings also need to have certain rituals, you know, to these gods which might change your mind. Dionysian, you know, Dionysos might be one. And you see it when you look at the rituals which have developed when you drink, for instance, wine. You wine, and when you go out, you know, you have a white tablecloth, and then you have very nicely dressed waiters. And then you have this big glass of wine for Burgundy. You need big glasses, and so. And then, of course, you have to have the appropriate, distinct behavior. Would you like to try? And then you try a little bit. And then there's the wording. You have to have a story. Well, this is a Burgundy Chateau Lavite. It comes from the year da da da. You could say this is all nonsense. You know, it's just talking. You know. But it's actually a ritual, giving it a story in order to control, a container, you know. You can compare it actually to, you know, how it's been in churches. Also, it's a very container because it has an influence. And things like that. I think wine drinking has a semi-religious, there's a quality notion about it, you know, so it's actually cultivated. So you see, again, there is actually, we're adhering to another goddess. And that's why the church, people don't go to church anymore, because they can go out and dine and eat. Because that's actually a substitute. And you also have to pay. When you go to church, you don't have to pay in Switzerland, which is actually a disadvantage. You know, it's not good. You should actually also be able to pay, because then you give something and you take something. You have to give to the gods. You can't just take. That's not possible. If you just take, then it's aggressive act from the other side. So this is also something, it's a semi-divine act. You could also see, you know, if you look at these relationships, it's also, you can also value relationship from relationship have many different gods, many different mythologies, of course, because it's something so wide. Also, it's with fulfillment, it's a personalization, can have something narcissistic. Often, by the empathy trap, it's a sort of a dual illusionary world where one adheres to a certain myth. You know, the certain myth, it can be an escapism myth, you know, it can be, the relationships can also be looked at, and also noise. I talked about noise before, and it's interesting if you look at the different noises. Music is usually, music is usually the noise from which is most Apollinic, because Apollo tries to cultivate it, tries to use rules and regulations. So there you have an Apollinic quality. So when you listen to classical music, to controlled music, and you sit down and you listen, it and you control. But then you have other types of music. You know, if you listen, for instance, to beatbox or, you know, house music, then the beat is very important. It has to be extremely loud so you get deaf. Take away the talking, so you're just actually emotional. So this might have more a Dionysian quality, or Pan. You have to have fear, you know, you get, in like in a hysteria, you get manic, you know, so that's important in certain types. So you have Pan, this quality, actually, which is being expressed there, Pan and Apollo. Pop concerts are also often adherent to that. So you see, what we do with noise is very much has to do actually, you can look at it from an archetypal value. And you can see these patterns actually from a psychological view, we're following, although we think we're making own choices, but I think we're searching in the different realms, you know, in shopping centers, in going, when we go out to eat, in relationships, there's all an undercurrent, there's another energy there guiding us, another energy which puts you in a certain area where we try to find something. Interestingly enough, there is a kind of a defense against it, maybe a defense by admitting it. So you don't go to the shopping center and admit, well, I'm going there because for me this is religious, because I'm searching. You don't do that. You have another kind of rhetoric, you know, of course. But when you look at the actual pattern, it's that what is actually happening. So there I think that we have a contradiction or sort of an unawareness in our society. Or in other words, I'm not sure if this is correct, but sometimes I have the impression the religious patterns have become so strong that they're lived by people without realizing it and without actually out really cultivating it. So I come now to the last part, the conclusions. And I think one conclusion is, I think it needs some kind of awareness. I think this is something which is important in our society, because especially in affluent societies like the especially affluent society, I think it's very important that we realize there is an undercurrent, other notion there, and maybe one has to search also for other vessels, other containers, maybe. I'm not sure if it's the pursuit of happiness really leads to happiness if we all have four or five new houses. You know, it somehow doesn't, there's no end to it. So that's a way which actually seems like a dead end. So it needs a realization that we have these other issues which are intermingled with all this. And also, you know, doing sports and trying to be slim and sort of torturing yourself. I'm not sure if this is really the goal, because we all get older and so on. So it's somehow it also seems a bit dense. So there I think it probably needs a new kind of awareness, an awareness that these undercurrent things are around us. And then we might be able to connect with what is what's going there. We might be able to see what actually is talking to us or what is open to us. It probably also needs rituals. Rituals, I mean patterns where we always do the same. We have a tendency, because it's difficult to identify what the content is, somehow to always change. You know, always change. Change has become a word as a value. But change, when you change, there's a danger that you don't see the essence. You don't detect the essence. So you actually need patterns where you always the same happens, because then afterwards you can probably see more in depth. It's like Japanese tea rituals. I once talked to a Japanese and said, we don't need personality assessments in Japan. We don't need that. You know, we've got something far better. We have the tea ritual. And the tea ritual, everything is defined. And if everything is exactly defined, we can detect the essence of a person a lot quicker. That's something I experienced also when I was in the Swiss Army. We all had to wear the same uniforms. But it was for me interesting to see how the personalities were obvious, you know, because everyone, you could suddenly see the different movements people had. You could suddenly see the different demeanors people had. You could see it by, because everyone was dressed the same. So and that's the same with rituals. So if we had rituals always the same, then maybe we could detect a bit deeper and we wouldn't get less distracted. So distraction probably is a kind of avoidance, and we try to get changed, but it's all so the energy comes from striving, trying to find something more deeper. And the last point is, I think it's important that we take value, heritage or history. Something I liked about Jungian psychology is that Jungian psychology has a place for culture, has a place for history, has a place for mythology. And as you know, mythology, history, these are things which are very important. And in the current education, this theory or psychology, the only things which are of value have to be things which are produced the last 3 or 4 years. Everything before is kind of irrelevant. You know, it has to be evidence-based and published at least the last 10 years. You can't quote something from the 1999. That's far too old, which is crazy. Which means that the whole mythological process, you know, the evaluating over the years, this is completely ignored and they usually land in a very ignorant point of view. So that's what I wanted to say. Actually, basically I wanted to say to put a perspective into the way we can look at society. And I think a lot of phenomena in our society, the way we live, the way we pursue happiness, we can, when we take Jungian psychology, we can actually see it from a bit deeper level, I think, and maybe gain some kind of awareness of what is happening. No?
No, that's okay. Okay, so I have a question.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the notion of uniforms and the notion of color.
Yeah. Sorry.
So, I'm wondering if it maybe has to do with the notion of spirit versus soul.
Yes.
And soul expression. So the idea is, when I was in the monastery, there was a time I was in the monastery in Pecos.
Yeah.
When I first was there, we just wore whatever we wanted to. And then there was this move to have everybody wear white.
Yeah.
Benedictine white, whatever. There. So, and I remember one of the older crone women in the monastery saying that that wasn't honoring the feminine, that it wasn't so expression, that women needed to be able to express in color to express the full feminine,
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So, is there a place with the five senses that soul expresses, or does it distract?
I think that's exactly one of the big problems, because on one hand, you know, when you take actually the different colors, it can be an expression, of course, of the different notions, but the problem is you identify it individually, you do it maybe individually, so it might be there's something more deep which you could then try to find out. And then it can be a distraction. So it's actually something one just has to be aware of. You couldn't make a distinct rule. I wouldn't say, well, everyone has to be dressed exactly the same, because that's when soul expresses itself better, but or more directly. But we have to realize this kind of tendency, because when you dress, or everyone dresses differently, it conceals actually what could be expressed, you know? It could conceal it. So. But I don't think there's a clear answer to it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm just trying to get this. So it's actually like two tendencies, you know. So, but our tendency is, and the naive belief is, that the more we dress, you know, personally, individually, the more we express ourselves. There's another notion that It adheres to the illusion that the way we dress ourselves is according to our personality. And as I said to begin with, this is an illusion. What we actually do, we abide to the rules of our society. So if it's en vogue to dress in red, to show passion, we dress in red, although it's actually not connected to us. But when we dress more modestly and don't make such pay that much attention, then maybe something else would express itself. So, yeah.
So how does discernment and what do I want to say, free will, sort of come in here? Is free will a completely illusionary concept?
No, it's not completely illusionary concept. But I mean, we have to realize the limits of free will. Just the idea that we are actually in control of ourselves, and that what we say while we're doing something is actually the real reason. So we always have to be skeptical. So, but we can make comments, and maybe we have a kind of little bit of influence, maybe. But we have to, we shouldn't be sure about it. Maybe the influence we're attributing to something we're doing is actually not really there. So we really have to be just skeptical about it. But this idea that we are the ones who decide, you know, whatever, this is a big fallacy. Yeah?
Yesterday, our speaker, Regina Schweitzer, I guess?
Yeah.
Talked about this dream of CPO, and this thing, the temple, building the temple, as maybe a metaphor for what Jungian psychology could help us as a societies and as our world evolves. I think you were speaking to that some when you said things like we need more awareness. Is the Jungian philosophy and the Jungian way of seeing things going to have these kind, do you perceive it as having this impact on your work and maybe on society that we're moving to, or maybe building the temple, which is the future of a world in which people are more aware, more at ease with each other, violence is less, all that kind of.
But we have to hear a lot of violent stories in order to be less violent.
Yeah.
Well, that's become, yes. Yeah. You know, because the stories, that's we have to, all the possibilities actually, which are sort of around the sort of the traits or the psychological possibilities, have to be somehow symbolized. So, you know, as I said, we need violent stories because the shadow issue also needs to be presented. So maybe if we start to dream of a world like that, it would be a world where there's also a lot of violence virtually present but not lived out. So violent stories. But you wanted to ask something or say something?
Well, no, what you're saying reminds me of the movies that sometimes the Sylvester Stallone and all that kind of stuff, and the guns and the violence and the rushing and the, you know, battles. Even the animated movies have a lot of that sometimes.
Yeah.
And is that then you would look at that as one healthy outlet for the shadow side?
It very varies how it's done. Because, you know, if you look at violent movies, it could be a symbolization, you know, so it could be a step from reality into another realm, where you some kind of look at the energy which is expressing itself. But of course a movie, especially when it's too explicit, you know, and too concrete, connected with the world, then of course it has another meaning. Then it means giving ideas or patterns, you know, what to do in you, to be aggressive in your respective surrounding. So it depends how it's done. You actually should symbolize it more, cultivate it in a certain way. That would be actually what you should do.
Symbolize it more, cultivate it.
Yeah, like in
yes,
like, you know, if you look at these soils, there's a lot of violence there, you know.
In what?
These soils, you know. Homer? Homer.
Oh, yeah. So
there's a lot of violence. Homer, there's a lot of violence here. But I don't think it's something which would induce violence if someone reads Odysseus.
Yes.
Because it's put in another realm,
yes,
in another area, you know. But if you have, for instance, a group of, let's say, strikers somewhere who strike, and then someone comes, well, you know, the really vile people are our bosses. You know, they did this and this, and
yeah,
they did, so then it's very concrete, and this of course might induce violence.
Yeah.
So it depends, you have to just take it away from reality. That's when actually the symbolic meaning comes out more clearly.
Yeah. Yes, taken away from reality
yeah.
to get to the symbolic meaning.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
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 I work with teenagers. I'm a teacher, mm-hmm. and they have emotional problems. And I heard a talk by Michael Mead where he goes around mm-hmm. and has violent teenagers express their story in
yeah.
poetry or music. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you what I heard that you work with people mm-hmm. with the nonviolence and using drama.
Yeah.
What exactly do you do?
I do something very similar like Michael, and actually we corresponded also with each other about that. We have a similar method. What we do actually when we work with violent youth, we see that they need a vessel, they need images, you know, for what is going on. So what I do, I call it mythodrama, and in mythodrama, we select the story which mirrors their challenges, their situation. And so we give them a story, and the story has to be has to have certain qualities. So it has to be a story which transfers the whole issue in another realm, so it shouldn't be too concrete. It has to contain certain figures, so we define the figures, and the figures we usually define according to archetypes. Maybe it should be a trickster, an Apollonic figure, a friend, a mentor. So you have these kind of figures which we sometimes introduce beforehand. And then the story also should be a bit on the limits. So it can be an outrageous story where things happen which one usually gets shocked. So it's not moralistic. That's very important. It widens the whole perspective. And it has, of course, a lot of symbols. And then we stop the story in mythodrama just before the climax and then invite the adolescents to imagine the end. How does it continue? What would you do? Select a figure. You know, which figure would you be and what would you do in that position? And then they either tell their ending or they play it out. So they might do drama and then they, you know, they rehearse their drama. And then at the very end, we might register, film it or so. And then at the very end, we say, well, okay, what does this tell you for your life? For the challenges you meet in your area, you know, being a violent, does this tell you something? And then they have to draw conclusions, which should be concrete then. And concrete means, okay, I'll try this and this. I chose this role, and he did this and this in the story, and so I found out this is a role which suits me. So he has to sort of transfer it to his own life. That's basically what we do in mythodrama. We use it in therapy. We use it with interventions, when we do crisis interventions in schoolhouses, when we work with youth. That's the way. It's an indirect approach, actually, to the issues of in crisis situations. But it's similar to what Michael does. Very similar. Yeah.
That scene that we watched last night, the world theater.
Yes.
That was the heavy violence and noise.
Yes.
And everything as you were expressing to bring out the shadow.
Yeah.
Jarring.
Yes. Of course, you're in the Catholic area here, as you realize, and the Catholics have a better understanding for the notion of symbols. So in contrast to Protestant Zurich, which has a different quality, you know, so this is very, and it's very much embedded in the culture of Einsiedeln. So this Welttheater is something I think very, very interesting, fascinating. You know, I think it's done every 4 or 5 years, or every seven years, so it's something. Yeah, and it's also done by everyone. Everybody joins in. Yes, so it's something which is very much, it's not done by some sort of, cultural in people, you know, which are usually more detached. It's something which comes bottom up. So that's why I think it's so fascinating. You have figures which are usually politically incorrect otherwise in normal theater. Yeah.
You just referred to the Catholicity here,
yes.
and the attachment to symbols. Yet there's a tremendous improvement away from membership in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Would you care to comment on what the repercussions of that would be in our society?
Yes. I mean, in Switzerland, it's interesting to see the tendency away from church is a lot less common in Catholic areas. It's in our country, and so in Catholic areas, the Catholic Church is more important. But it's difficult. I couldn't give you an answer for that, but I think one reason is what I said before. Maybe a lot of the symbols, you know, have been secularized, you know, secular. When you go into a shopping mall, they're actually secularized. Maybe a church doesn't demand enough, you know, sort of just gifts. Has become too social, maybe. That's a sort of an idea. I think it's always difficult when you something is just there for free. You know, nobody wants something for free. And so maybe we would need different rituals. I don't know, I'm fantasizing now, but this is an idea. Of course, in Switzerland, the Catholic Church had a lot of social meaning. And I think the way I perceive it in the United States, you know, belonging to a church also has a social meaning. But this is no longer the case. So, you know, people used to go to attend to church because afterwards there was an apéro. They would drink a glass of wine and join each other and talk about what's going on. So it had an enhanced social cohesion. And now somehow the population has changed a bit. But the Catholic Church still has a very important role in our country. You know, sometimes you distinguish people by being Catholic or Protestant. They, of course, both share a lot. But I think we can distinguish someone being a Catholic or someone being a Protestant. We can distinguish without knowing it. So it's actually this notion, this diversion is still here.
Thank you.
Catholics usually drink more. And can party better. That's what it says. Party. They party better. The best that you know. What? They like to celebrate. And so is it the kid. Okay, other comments?
Anybody want to ask or comment on?
Yeah.
I think you made a very important point. That's what I heard you say, that dreams are the language of the soul.
Yeah.
Are there other, that's probably a key issue, isn't it?
The key, I think this is something we have every night, dreams. I think.
Yeah.
Of course there's other things, of course there's fantasies maybe, there's imagination, there's emotions, there's soul glimpses that we suddenly get touched. It's by what we remember when we reflect. Mm-hmm. You reflect what to... If we reflect what happens, maybe happened the week past, you know, maybe what keeps in our minds, you know, so things like that are also entrances into what is actually going on. And I think we usually don't pay enough tribute to that, you know. I always try with my students in Zurich, I always try after giving a course that, tell me what you remember, you know, anything. But it's so difficult, they usually always tend to reproduce what they got in writing. Then, no, it could be anything, something completely different. And sometimes, you know, they realize, when I went home, I had this, and, you know. And so I think there's like no notion, you know. I said, I gave you material, but I want to know, what did it do with you? You know, and did something maybe which was not on the agenda. Yeah?
When you said soul selects what is important,
yeah.
And you mentioned falling in love or choosing a
yes.
partner. What if that choice that seemed kind of irrational because you were drawn to this person causes a lot of pain and it was heartbreak? And so how would you figure that in? Did the soul need that lesson? Or?
It doesn't mean, you know, you don't have to pursue every time you fall in love with someone doesn't mean you really have to live it out. And so you have to distinguish there. So there's a lot of images which come up which might be important but which don't really have to be cultivated. You know, so that's also a misunderstanding. So, well, it's like, I know from this notion, I told it once here a long time ago, I think, this notion of this man who left his family in Zurich. He went on a plane to Tokyo, and then he was served by an air hostess. And then I think over Dubai, they realized they somehow get along with each other very well. over India they really fell in love, and then in Japan they spent 3 days together, and then he returned home and said, I'm leaving my family and everything, and the whole relationship got a complete catastrophe. It was a tremendous misunderstanding, because, but it actually was the misunderstanding, because it had a content, of course, it had a message, of course, you know, an up in the air, you know, anything is possible. So it was important to value it, but not to maybe take it too concretely. So I think there we have to somehow value things. It doesn't mean, you know, that then you, with all these, when you talk about mythology, you know, you have this myth, you have these gods, which have a lot of power, but it doesn't mean you have to abide them all the time. You can resist. You know, they're not always right. Might be also wrong. That's where maybe I will come in. You have to struggle, fight. Yeah.
Yeah. Came to mind, like a circle here, and yeah. Came to mind, a circle one off the other. Would that be yeah. Soul language speaking to you?
Absolutely. That's something we do also with when we work with young people in therapy. We make a collage and say what kind of events to keep in your mind. And some of them are even fantasized, purely pure fantasy. But that's exactly, you know, we just say what is your story actually? And the story you give yourself usually has certain key events, and the key events are more mythology than reality, as one knows, but it then actually reveals actually your soul story. Yeah. Yeah.
Your question is, are stress a defense against soul glimpses?
Yes.
Or is it an attack, or is it a defense? I mean, are we stressed so we can't touch, you know, soul, or are we doing that for
the... Yeah, I think we have a stress because we're striving for something, but actually we don't realize what the real goal is. I mean, the stress, I'm saying, if someone has four houses, you know, he's coming under more and more stress, but actually he's searching for something else, and he doesn't realize it, you know, so actually this is what creates the stress, because you search outside by doing it, by controlling it, and not just, you know... having a notion, well, I have to wait. Maybe it comes, maybe not, maybe. To look at it symbolically.
Yeah, and what we long for is also what we're afraid of.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. That's an important comment you're making now, because we fear not being under control, not controlling something. This is a tremendous fear. We all, you know, not being aware, not knowing what would happen. So this is something we don't like. So we want to control things, but at the same time, if you control something too much, then we avoid maybe the uncontrollable, you know.
The Apollo and
yeah.
Dionysus.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Apollo
like
and Dionysus.
Like with the wine.
Yes.
You know, we've got to drink wine, but we have to be in control.
Yeah, yeah. In yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true.
In action.
Just a couple things that came up while you were talking, just if I could, will comment. Emily Dickinson, the American poet, has a poem, The Soul Selects Her Own
Company.
Yeah, I could send it to you. Mm-hmm. People remember that? Yeah, and you're almost using the same language.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then the other thing that came up was when someone asked about love. I remember a line from Susan B. Anthony, and she was a famous American feminist who mm-hmm. got the vote for women in about 19... Well, she was dead, actually, when the law was passed that women could vote in the United States. It was 1920. But Susan B. Anthony was always interviewed by people, and she never married, and she was a Quaker. And one time, this Nellie Bly, a very famous journalist, asked her, have you ever been in love? And she said, I've been in love 1,000 times.
Yeah, that's nice.
But she never married.
She never married.
Her passion was equality.
Yeah. That's nice.